the Scan On Podcast, your weekly podcast look at the week in film, Irish International. I'm Darren, and joining me are...
Roman.
Luke.
Jason.
Grace.
So we'll be doing the usual thing where we'll be talking through the week in film and also the top 10. But let's begin with what we watched since the last we talked. What have we watched since last we talked, Roman?
Since last we talked, we went to the cinema together despite not seeing each other.
We didn't realize it. It was just a visible connection there. Yeah. No, we didn't realize it until afterwards. It was beautiful.
We saw each other's tweets. Real modern experience.
Yeah.
Realize that we're in the same room.
A 21st century romance.
Yeah.
We sat in the dark and stared at the screen without really acknowledging each other's presence. It was magical.
We went to the IFI's Mystery Matinee for the month, which is always a fun initiative, and was, I think, I have to say, a genius stroke of programming this month, because it was Citizen Ruth. Alexander Payne's abortion comedy, which I think is the most concise way to frame it.
Tells you everything you need to know about the movie, good and bad.
Yeah, I think
also Ireland this week.
Ireland is not quite Alexander Payne's abortion comedy.
It's Payne though.
It's not as witty though. Yeah, just drop the Alexander.
Yeah, that's I think exactly why it was such a great stroke of programming. In that I was just saying to Jay, I think if you had specifically programmed that film, the audience wouldn't have been anywhere as big. So walking into the room and everyone sort of slowly realizing whether they were familiar with the film or not, that this is what we're in for. You know, 2 hours of abortion gags and like poking fun at the abortion debate. It was really cathartic, I thought, that there was this really strange experience of everyone in the room gradually, you know, feeling uncomfortable, moving from discomfort to just hilarity. And I have to say, I kind of like awkwardly tittered for a while and then just wound up howling with laughter. Because it was so, like, it was so good to be able to laugh about this for a little while after everything we've been through. And it's a really, really funny film. And I know you have quite a few reservations about it, and I...
You made it sound like a laundry list. I really just got one.
Okay.
That's the four words: Alexander Payne abortion comedy. But
no, I agree with. I agree that it has its share of problems in the way he does that. It's, I think, really cynical and generally quite mean a lot of the time. But that is also part of what made it so funny for me. That there's such ruthless gags in there sometimes, and I think in a different context I might have been more critical of it, but in this context I was just like, oh my god.
Well, it was a stroke of programming genius.
It was absolutely genius programming.
It was
it
fantastic
really
programming.
Was. I think it's...
Less taken with it than you, as we may have guessed there. The issue for me was that Payne's comedy like amounts to scathing contempt for everyone.
Yep,
which is grand if you're talking about a political debate, and this in some ways involves a political debate. It was more the central character and the way in which she became... She was, you know, at once, obviously, the character, the protagonists were meant to latch onto, but at the same time, there was this weird, is she the punchline as well of this joke that he's telling?
Yeah.
And it's like, and that works very well when he's joking about middle-aged, middle-class men who are trapped in their own anxieties, played by Matthew Broderick. Didn't work quite as well when you're talking about an indigent woman, as she's described repeatedly over the course of the film, who huffs paint and is played by Laura Dern, who is fantastic in this. In fact, the entire ensemble's great. Mm-hmm. I wasn't quite as on board with it.
But I agree with you entirely. It was kind of, it was almost more the experience than the film itself that I enjoyed to a huge degree. I completely agree. I think the characterization is really, really dodgy at points. And Laura Dern gives it her all, but she is sort of, the odds are stacked against her, and that script is not nice in how it deals with her. And I think that is a huge problem. It's a problem I've had throughout Payne's trajectory, but as you say, it feels less mean when it's somebody
punching down.
Absolutely. But as I say, I laughed so much, so much.
You're laughing still.
I really am. Oh, it was a good experience.
You need that though. I think I was saying to some of the people I work with, like, we've reached the stage where we're borderline hysterical over things that aren't even funny, just because we need to attention.
Yeah, and to sort of so openly be invited to laugh at this whole subject. I kind of got to a point in the middle of the film where I was like, I didn't think I could laugh about this, and to be able to.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. It was like the biggest weight off my chest. I felt so light afterwards.
Because you'd sit there and be so serious all the time.
Yeah.
This is rough. I just want to laugh. God's sake.
It's like you say, I think hysterical is the right word.
Yeah.
Just totally worn out by it.
Yeah. Join the Ireland Simpsons fans group on Facebook and I just laugh at everything. What's wrong with me? I just can't.
But even that's
anymore.
Been politicized. Yeah, right. Was it Martin Prince hanging posters? Yeah. There was a no campaign. Anyway, we won't
go that's
that. Everything is political in this day and age.
Yeah.
It's exhausting.
And the one other thing I'll flag that I had That was actually, that was an incredible screening experience for me, for the reason I mentioned. But I had another really, really strange grade screening experience this week, which was seeing Certified Copy in the IFI on 35mm, which is one of my favourite films from the last decade. And I was really excited to go see a print of it, because I absolutely loved it. It was one of my favourite films that year. And, you know, I haven't seen it since it came out, which was about 6 years ago here, I think. So I, you know, went expecting to love it, and it's partly to do with the nature of the film and its construction of its narrative. It's partly to do with the fact that it's about aging and the way people change over time, and I guess it's partly to do with possibly personal circumstances. But it really struck me, like, I loved it so much more than I loved it the first time, which is strange because, you know, one of my favorite films of the last decade, I love more. It was an incredible experience, and it's a long time since I've had that with a film that I've previously seen, where you kind of reinterpret it in that way, where it means so much to you based on the way that you've changed, the way it's changed, the way your perspective has changed. And I think the film is built to do that.
It's the nature of it.
Absolutely, because it's exactly about the way your perspective on people and events and relationships changes. And then when you revisit the film, and it hammers that home, and obviously it's so much of it is built as well on Gira Dinoche's performance, which communicates. What's really interesting to me is the way that it plays almost like the sixth edition in a before movie.
Yes, it does. Yeah,
it plays like it could be the sixth one in that, and it has all the weight of five films that don't exist.
Yeah, it's a tardiness as well.
But
it plays with even the idea of meeting and the idea of coming together in any significant way.
And the way the narrative is constructed is so clever that these characters they evolve completely in terms of themselves and their relationships throughout the course of the film. And coming back to it a second time, knowing what the nature of their relationship is.
I actually haven't rewatched it, and I really want to rewatch in that context.
It is so built for a rewatch. And you know this once you've seen it once, though.
Yeah.
When you watch it a second time, you spot hints and clues as to what's going on. But I really bowled over by it. Sort of came out of the cinema and was just wandering around the city in a daze, realised that I'd been walking around for an hour, and I was like, where am I going? It was that kind of experience that I was just completely lost. I adored it, and I can't wait to see it again.
Right, so Luke,
kind of in preparation for this week's big blockbuster release, one thing that I've been doing over the last week is revisiting previous Star Wars films, specifically the ones that feature Han Solo. And that's been interesting to me because I think audiences are going to be going into Solo, A Star Wars Story, with certain expectations about that character and a certain understanding of that character. And what's interesting to me in revisiting those films is to see how maybe how they see him isn't quite how he actually is. You know, there's that famous bit in Red Letter Media's takedown of the Star Wars prequels where they go through the characters in Star Wars and like describe these characters and describe their character traits.
Yeah.
The idea being that
none of the more characters are memorable.
The more traits that you can give a character, the better they are, the more memorable they are. The idea being that the characters from the prequels were not memorable and the characters from the originals were. And the way that they describe Han Solo in that is he's charming, he's this charismatic scoundrel, he's a hit with the ladies. And none of that is really accurate at all. Han Solo, you know, having watched the three original films and The Force Awakens, is a crabby, often incompetent, bad smuggler. He's not good at his job often. And like a hit with the ladies, not really. Not so much. I think, like, Leia as a character is a lot more drawn to Han when he behaves like an adult, and maybe certain Star Wars fans don't pick up on that. And like, he's so frequently the comic relief in those films. It's really interesting. If you look at A New Hope, it's like when they jump down into the trash compactor. He literally, when he jumps down, it's literally like a cartoon character diving, and he yells like he's like Goofy or like a cartoon character. And then when you get to Return of the Jedi, that whole opening sequence, which is centered around Han and rescuing Han, he's like He's a bumbling, he's like Mr. Magoo. He can't see. He's constantly making jokes that make him look really silly. And yeah, I think, you know, there's a skepticism from certain people going into Solo because it's like, oh, it was originally going to be all comedy and like Alden Ehrenreich. I can't pronounce his last name. I'm sorry.
Ehrenreich.
Thank you. The way he's playing that character, is it going to be too comedic? Is he going to be as cool and charismatic as Harrison Ford? And, you know, he's in many ways a comedic character. I think in a lot of ways, how people see Harrison Ford and have seen Harrison Ford in the decades since the original Star Wars films bleeds into how they remember.
I think it's actually people misremember Indiana Jones when they think about Han Solo. I think that's the problem.
I think it's also a film that's tied up in star power, and that's Harrison Ford. Ford is this sort of, you know,
definitely.
Absolutely, and that's like very much what was going on.
Plus, he flies planes,
but even
crashes them
on golf courses.
Even Indiana Jones, and it's the same thing, but, you know, cool and charismatic. Indiana Jones is a crabby academic.
Yeah, but Harrison Ford's a crabby
academic. He's a crabby man.
But
he's also repeatedly incompetent.
But with that star power, it's like, I think Harrison Ford is just so handsome that people think back and they're like, he must be charismatic.
I think Han Solo's character really just got lucky when they cast Harrison Ford to play him. Mm. It's kind of like in Jurassic Park, the way, what's called a casting Jeff Goldblum as
Malcolm.
Malcolm makes that character so much more endearing than he would be otherwise.
But he was almost cut.
And in the book, he was like fat and bald. So, you know, I don't know what they read to cast him. But still, it's the same thing. You know, it's the actor that makes the character much more interesting than they would be as written, perhaps.
Absolutely.
And that leads into people's perceptions of it.
That's been really kind of interesting for me to look at, because I think Harrison Ford's performance in those films is so good that it's led generations of people to see Han Solo the way Han Solo sees himself.
Yeah, pretty much.
Got his thesis on that.
Yeah. Hopefully. It's for research purposes.
Sure. It was.
Best-selling book.
The other thing I've been watching, we might be talking about it later, I'm not sure, is Citizen Lane. I managed to catch that on Monday.
We won't be, but we could talk about it now.
Yeah, I enjoyed it quite a bit, actually. It's a few of my sweet spots. You know, it's got history, it's got Irish history, it's got art, it's got municipal planning.
all our favorites.
So all the things that are going to make it number one in the top ten, I assume. But that kind of, the way that Citizen Lane combines kind of the documentary with, you know,
the scripted scenes
is really interesting. And I've not really seen anything like that in a documentary before to that extent. And I think it kind of worked pretty well. It's at points it was awkward, I felt. Because if there's one thing that I have kind of a bugbear about in films about history or in prequels, there are a lot of examples of this in Solo, it's the
interlocking
knowing
continuity.
Hey, Mr. Chaplin, have you ever considered becoming an actor, kind of a thing. And that crops up in Citizen Lane.
A little
more than once, but I, you know, it was still very, very interesting.
Is it a documentary? Like, what is it? Because I'm none the wiser.
It's a strange mix of talking heads, reconstructed scenes, and like direct to camera addresses from people dressed as historical figures.
I'm always a bit wary of
that. Reading letters. I assume they're reading letters.
I think
right?
So.
I'm always a bit wary of reconstructed scenes in documentaries.
Yeah,
because I'm a documentary traditionalist for the most part. So although the reviews have been pretty good, like I'm not dismissing it. I'm always wary of it as well.
I don't know that it'll work for everybody because in some senses it is kind of like two films put together. But,
You can mesh, I suppose.
But if, you know, Hugh Lane isn't necessarily the most well-known Irish figure.
I think it's no bad thing either, though, in that regard. Like, so it's not the kind of traditional
thing. Giving Tom Von Lawler, you know, putting him in this performance as Hugh Lane, I think that kind of helps people to get on side with who he is and understand where he's coming from. I think, you know, I think Tom Von Lawler in the film does a very good job of showing him as this person is primarily interested in art and passionate about art. I think you feel that, and that it would be an interesting film. It's one that I would definitely recommend because of that, you know, unique approach that it uses.
Yeah, it's incredibly charming.
Yeah.
It is a bit, as you point out, sort of Justice League of turn of the 20th century Dublin.
Yeah.
Where it's like, oh my god, were you there at J.M. Singh's premiere? I saw Yeats there too. It is a little bit like
maybe it's a prequel for the setup for that.
Yeah,
like, this thing,
the Dublin Literary Universe.
Finally, it's going to be poster like that. You know, the Universal poster.
Yeah.
Except it's just going to be Tom Von Lawler and various people playing. You know,
the Celtic revival cinematic universe.
Introducing Sean O'Casey, Liam Neeson. That's, you know, that kind of stuff. I'd really watch that.
Yeah. Tell me that isn't the future of Irish cinema right there. But it is very charming. It's incredibly charming. It's well observed. The dialogue's fantastic, written by Mark O'Halloran, I believe,
provided
the dramatic sequences. Directed by Ty O'Sullivan. It's really good and it's really interesting, and it makes, I think, a compelling case for the idea of like art in an urban space.
Yeah.
Because obviously with the gallery and his plans and all that sort of stuff. So it's a very nice, it's a very heartwarming film in many ways. I really, really liked it.
That's a nice gallery as well.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, so
I was cheering from the gallery.
Hey!
O'Sullivan, you know, he's an experienced hat. I think it's cool to see him do something different like this.
Mm-hmm.
To put those, you know, two different ways of presenting a narrative together. Think, yeah, I don't know if everybody would think that it works, but for me, it definitely did. Yeah.
Cool.
Right, so Jay, what did you watch? Jay has brought a printout.
I did,
for
paper printing.
There's two reasons for that. One, because I hate, and as much as I love Letterboxd, to click into stuff to remember what I thought of it, and then have to click back out, and you know, it's just exhausting, particularly because my brain is addled. And second reason, because my brain is addled. So I have it, so I put them all together. Because I actually watched a bit this week, or 2 weeks, since I've been on. Was it 2 weeks? Was I on last week? Last week.
I think it may have been about 3 weeks.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's been a long month.
Yeah.
Hasn't it? So I've watched a bit.
Get your vitamins for your OJ right here.
Yes, indeed. Right, one of the ones I'll start with is a film called Daisies, which is a 60s Czech New Wave film by I'm going to remember her name now, Vera Chiltalova. That sounds right. That has to be right. I was discussing with Ronan earlier, there's a thing that happens, particularly in film movements. Ronan mentioned the Dogma one, and I think he's correct, where Susan Beer gets kind of written out a little bit, puts in Lars von Trier and Thomas Hinsberg kind of take up the space, and I think in the Czech New Wave, I think, as a beautifully pronounced Vera Chiltalova, who I was aware of the film existing, but I was never aware of who directed it or that there was a woman director in that movement. She's the only one that came into the Czech Film School at the time. And this film's called Daisies, and it's a really, really surreal, weird, in the way mid-60s films can be, about two young girls, and they are kind of young, it's unspecified, but it's just kind of post-school age kind of thing, but that kind of young malaise of not really wanting to do anything in society, so they just decide to kind of wreck it. So they kind of, there's moves from kind of skit to skit, and it's been shot in various different colours depending on what happens, and colours switch and scenes switch, and there's kind of montage effects, and it's all like really skillful technical stuff happening whilst it's almost on the verge of now and again of breaking into a kind of custard pie fight. There's that kind of element to it. But it's brilliantly funny and wild. And these girls basically just kind of chat these older men up in restaurants. They keep eating all the time. They never stop eating. Like, get order the most expensive stuff and champagne and stuff. And then they go, you're going to miss your train. And they rush him to the train station. And they rush him on the train. They get on the train. Then they get off. They go to the other side of the car. They just get off and leave him on the train. And they just do this to kind of various different blokes. But they just destroy nightclubs and restaurants just haphazardly, but in this kind of casual way. And it's magnificently staged. Film technically put together, really, really funny, and it has this kind of underlying thing, because I think she was the only director in that, reading up on it in the kind of Czech film school at the time, where they're kind of chopping up pickles and bananas and sausages, and it's very clear what she's going to get out of here, like of that kind of, like, you know, castration element to it, and it's really funny in that regard, and political in that regard at the time, but it's really great, like top notch, can't take your eyes off the screen, kind of flies along at a real zip and top stuff. Really, really worth seeing. And the other one I'll mention is Faces Places, which is the Agnès Varda film, which is not out here apparently till September, which is quite a bit away.
I think by the time it comes out, it will have been about a year and 3 months since it played here in festivals.
Yeah.
It's such a long time.
It was an Oscar nominated documentary. The word was she was probably going to win, that didn't, so I can't remember what won the documentary Oscar this year. But anyway, but it's basically this kind of story where she and this kind of younger artist called JR basically go around the outskirts of France in various different towns, kind of just seeing what they see, photographing people. He has this kind of van that's kind of designed like a big old camera, and he could basically take photographs and print out large versions of them. So he like basically just like barns, and he'll take photographs and he'll paste up all the whole barn of people's faces and heads and stuff. And so it just kind of it starts off like a light kind of filled memories of different stories, people he meets and stuff. But it gets kind of more melancholic and kind of emotional as the film goes on, and it kind of touches on kind of previous filming and people and filmmakers and memories, particularly of Ireland, her memories of kind of when she was younger, and then she made films with people like Godard, who comes up hilariously in a kind of scene, but it kind of ruined it. But it comes to pass in the last 10-15
presence.
He does have a presence in the film, and but essentially it's just this kind of weird freewheeling double act that kind of marauds its way to the French countryside and beaches and stuff. And there is a beach scene that's incredible, actually, because there's this kind of I don't know what it is, a kind of thing that falls off the cliff and stuck into the beach, and they kind of put it's like a bunker, and they kind of put a kind of thing on the side of that, but then it gets kind of washed away in the water, so it's very emblematic of what the film is getting at. But it's really, really good. So when it comes out, I'm actually going to see it again when it comes out, because I'd like to see it in the cinema, because it's very visual, and whilst it's great at home, I think the cinema would be great for it.
Yeah, I saw it at the IFI French Film Festival, and I can't wait to see it again, because I think what's really fascinating about it is the way it almost feels like it's got a really rigid, carefully constructed thesis, but it's built in such a way that comes very naturally.
Yeah.
That they're just touring around the countryside meeting random people, and it feels so carefully structured.
Yeah, I like that about a documentary. I can kind of bury that kind of idea.
You realize by the time you get to the end of it that, oh, wow,
that's exactly what they were trying to do. Yeah, and it's very smart like that.
Yeah, it's really, really good on like aging and memory. There's some really interesting stuff about Varda not being able to see as well
and not being able to see his eyes because he wears his glasses all the time.
And it communicates that vision
beautifully.
It's one of these, you know, recent wave documentaries in the last maybe 10 years that are really playing around with visual representations.
Yeah. Oh, it's
great. It was Icarus that won, by the way, I believe, this year.
I haven't seen that. Oh, I should see that.
That's
the Netflix thing, right?
I think it might be.
That's on Netflix. I should really watch that. Anyway, Faces is really good, so we go see it.
I was really, really distraught as well, because Varda was obviously nominated as director of it, and would have been the oldest competitive Oscar winner in history just months after winning an honorary award. And I love it when people win a competitive Oscar right after an honorary award.
Because the honorary award is like, you're going to die soon.
Yeah, it's like, there you go, that's your life done.
Yeah, that would have been nice. It really would.
Chaplin's Limelight score for the win! 20 years after it was released.
Yeah, exactly.
How awful must have been to be one of the other four nominees competing against a film that was 20 years old with a score by Charlie Chaplin. Just like,
just bad timing, people.
Give me
bad
my also ran right now.
Mm-hmm.
See, the problem was, nobody went to Chaplin. You should win an Oscar, sir.
Yeah. Right, well, I saw Solo last night. Don't know if we'll be talking about that a bit later on, will we?
We will be.
Okay, well, I hold on my thoughts, or just...
You may hold on. We may take a hands-off approach.
Okay, cool. Well, I'll talk about that later, but I will say that I really liked it. Possibly even loved it. So, yeah, we'll talk about that later. What else have I seen? Last week I watched Psychokinesis, which is the... well, maybe it's more than a second film, but anyway, it's by the same director who made Train to Busan the other year.
Oh.
So it's a superhero movie, very quietly released on Netflix in the past couple of weeks, and it's... yeah, it's interesting. It's good, but not great. I think in one sense it might suffer a little bit from the fact that it's following Train to Busan, which is a fantastic film. But it's a very kind of frothy superhero story in the sense that, you know, it has this kind of... I think the problem with it is it doesn't quite nail its tone, because it's sort of going for a very comedic take on things with a lot of physical humor, a lot of like things falling over and blowing up, and people, you know, the type of scripts you see a lot of the time where people get powers and can't really control them and it causes all sorts of mess. But it plays out against this background of like people being evicted by like greedy corporations who want to take over slums and gentrify them and all this sort of stuff, and it's just a bit of a random mixture of those two stories, but it's entertaining, but I'm not sure it fully works overall. So yeah, would watch, but maybe don't rush out to see it. even if it is on Netflix.
I haven't seen Trains for Zan either, actually. I do mean to see it.
Do you know, I honestly don't know if you'd like it. Because really? You're just so difficult to read.
Yeah, part of the duty of this podcast is to curate films for Jay. It's a very tough full-time job for us.
But then
that's why I have four of
you
working at it.
You really love something, so, you know.
Oh no, this is just the public face. We have other people working in the back as well.
So it should be. Is that, what else
do you got? Do you know, I actually can't remember if I've watched any other films in the past 2 weeks. I have been rewatching Wynonna Earp, and I've been rewatching The Flash. Both of which are, well, I haven't seen the newer seasons of Wynonna Earp, but I'm assuming it's still good.
It's great.
Yeah, it's excellent. And the first season is on Netflix, and you should look it up if you get a chance. I love rewatching the first season of The Flash. I've seen it about 1,000 times at this stage, but it never gets any less enjoyable. Possibly all the more enjoyable because the subsequent seasons have nosedive into oblivion so spectacularly. But the first season is very well written, genuinely very affecting, brilliant character development, excellent villain. So much better than a superhero show has any right to be. So if you haven't seen it, then yeah, watch the first 1.5 seasons of The Flash. And
that's so specific.
It is. You can pinpoint the moment in the
where
second
it just falls
season
off
where it's... Yeah, because they sort of take one decision with a certain character that's completely out of the blue, and literally the instant that happens, you're just like, what? And then it all just goes to hell.
Oh.
So clearly someone got sacked in the writer's room, and...
I guess it was a flash in the pan, eh? Okay,
fine. So that's me.
Cool. I watched a bunch of stuff very, very quickly. I saw The Battle of Algiers for the first time the weekend, filling gap in my classic film.
Pretty good, eh?
It's pretty good. Yeah, it's pretty, pretty good. but yeah, it's wonderful. It's obviously massively influential in terms of directors who've been influenced by everyone from Ken Loach to Nicholas Winding Refn to Christopher Nolan to various other people. Yeah, very atmospheric. Holds up remarkably well. It is still apparently taught. The Pentagon held a screening of it in 2003 in order to understand the Iraqi insurgents. It's still screening worldwide. It famously banned in France. Nominated.
I'm shocked.
Yeah, I know. It's surprising. Denounced by Jean-Marie Le Pen.
What?
Who would have thought that? A movie about the evils of colonialism. And also nominated for the best... And we don't want to talk about like the wonders of the Oscar system. Nominated for best screenplay in 1967 and then nominated and winning best foreign film in 1968. Again, this is the wonders of how the system actually works. Yeah, it's strange. It's really, really strange.
I thought you were going to say it was beaten by
Charlie Chaplin.
Some terrible films I'm working on.
Movie, yeah.
A Charlie Chaplin film from 1957. Also watched The Secret in Their Eyes, which is also a first time watch for me. Which
the
is
original or?
The original. No, I saw the remake a little while ago and completely forgot about it. And it's great because when you're watching a superior foreign film that's been remade and you've watched the remake and it sort of disappeared from your mind, watching the foreign film kind of brings it back, but in a way that's like, oh,
that's what they're going for and failed to get.
That's how that's supposed to work. Because there's very literally, like, there's a character, for example, in the foreign film, they create a character for Julia Roberts, but that means usurping a character from the original film, and that changes the entire dynamic. And it's like, now the film works. It's very weird. But it's obviously fantastic. It's technically amazing. It has that wonderful 7-minute shot. Which allegedly won at the Oscar, one of the deciding factors that won at the Oscar, apparently, which opens with the camera zooming in over this football stadium, and in one of the most brazen moments in I think, like, Oscar campaigning history, you focus on a bunch of sports fans cheering, Academy! Academy! But it is an absolutely stunning sequence. It's fantastic. And the entire film is great. It's this wonderful study of memory and history and narrative and how we construct narrative to fill gaps in the official record and all that sort of stuff. I also saw Cargo on Netflix, which I
believe
this Jay watched.
I have,
this.
Yeah.
It was grand.
Darren, how is this possible? This can't happen.
You like a film more than I do?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's okay. It's what a great idea. So Cargo's, it's an adaptation of a short film. It stars Martin Freeman as a man who is basically bitten by a zombie in the Australian outbreak. And basically has to wander with his child and try and find a way to keep the child safe while he's in the process of transforming. It's a fantastic premise for horror movie. The issue is that it's very episodic.
Yeah.
While there are some great ideas there, in particular, it belongs to like the modern subgenre of colonial horror movie that involves the idea of like the creator, basically of the colonial forces being repelled and replaced by something new or something old. So, for example, Westworld has one, for example. The Girl with All the Gifts is another example. Ex Machina is another example. There's a whole subgenre recently of movies that basically go, the end of the world, maybe not such a bad thing. And Cargo is very much of that ilk.
Yeah,
it's got a lot of interesting things to say about the exploitation of natural resources and of the indigenous Aboriginal population. And I think that's all very interesting, but the plot is too episodic. And the storytelling is very much beat, beat, beat. It's everything that you expect, which is disappointing, given, like, you have the hook of you've been bitten by a zombie, you've got 48 hours, and you're carrying a baby. Like, this should be speed.
No, I think the first half it works quite well, and whilst I agree with you in terms of it does kind of, it is episodic, I didn't think it really damaged the film in any way. But the problem I had with it is that it's kind of half drama, half zombie film.
Yeah.
And it's neither, it's not quite as good, like it kind of loses a bit of both, rather than necessarily being committing to what it is, and I think it does kind of lose a little bit, but I thought it was decent, I enjoyed it. Freeman is great, the little kid is great, he doesn't have a word, like
yeah.
She's only one or something I think, so she like just basically expressive camera and looks around
yeah.
the place, which does really well.
Wonderful baby performance.
Yeah, yeah, it is.
No,
yeah. There's a few baby performances that they work on.
It's
hard
form.
It's
casting.
Good directing.
Directing a baby,
that, yeah.
casting a baby, it's amazing.
I quite like that. It was one of those things that I watched, happy I watched it.
Yeah, I mean, like,
6 months time if somebody asked me, I'd probably forgotten what happens.
Yeah.
But it's kind of enjoyed when I watched it.
Yeah. This is weird.
This is weird as well. I don't like this.
I have a higher standard than you do when it comes to a zombie movie. This is very odd. Very strange indeed.
Darren, we'll have to fix this. There'll be something
somehow,
along.
There'll be something
within the next 15 minutes, something else will come along and fix it.
And
yeah,
then,
don't worry
about
it.
Finally, makes sense again.
Because it's 26 years old, and everybody knows the 26th anniversary is the most special anniversary. Alien 3, I rewatched the assembly cut. It's fantastic!
Alien 3 is great.
Such a bleak, nihilistic,
yeah.
empty, harrowing, sort of horrible, mean-spirited, vindictive piece of cinema. It's fantastic. It's a movie that embraces the core tropes of the Alien franchise, which is that the universe is a cruel, barren, and heartless place in which love can never flourish, in which everything is trying to kill you, and takes that idea to its logical conclusion, the point where it murders an adorable four-year-old and then has you watch her autopsy in the opening half hour of the film. It kills off the characters that you cared about from the previous film. Its entire film is building towards the death of the one character who is supposed to survive the trilogy. It's a movie in which the only release and redemption that can be found is death, in that death is what excuses you from this heartless, cold, corporate, religious, spiritual universe.
So it's especially relevant this year, doesn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah, it sort of captures that. But it's so bleak. It's fantastically bleak. I can't think of a mainstream movie that has been this bleak and this committed to its bleakness. It's astounding. Like, there's literally a moment in it when the obvious parallel with the alien is that it's meant to be demonic, right? Because it's a creature, it arrives, it kills brutally, and it wreaks horrible spiritual vengeance. But in the world of Alien 3, it's very clear that the alien is God. It's a divine representative here to offer you redemption by taking you out of your misery. It's an incredibly...
Well, it is a prison planet as well.
It is a prison planet,
yeah.
Yes. It is literally a prison planet.
Yeah.
It's incredibly neat. And the assembly cut of the movie, which was cut together from the bits and pieces that were trimmed from Fincher's original cut for being far too weird. And they are very weird.
Yeah.
There's a moment where like Paul McGann like worships the alien as some sort of like embodiment of the representation of God. But it commits wholeheartedly.
It
to
no,
it
absolutely show. Does. It's the second best alien film. After Alien.
Nice
Sorry,
try.
Grace. It's the second
I
best.
Appreciate...
People are all demented. Alien 3 is a piece of crap.
No, it's not.
I completely unmitigated piece of crap.
Stop it, Grace.
I'm with
it's
you on
miserable.
This one, actually. I don't like it at all.
I love
there's
it. Board
there's
service.
Nothing enjoyable about Misery, as I would have thought
of
the Revenant proved
quite Misery
well.
Done well.
Also, it's much, much better than the Revenant.
It's
and
also
most things
it's appreciably better than the Revenant.
And it's great. I love it. Don't worry.
Thank you, Jay. This is weird.
It's really weird.
Yeah, I know.
You
right?
like things more, and now you're both agreeing.
But yeah, if
you
should
move swiftly on.
I think it's well worth an evaluation. I also think it's a nice bridge into Prometheus and Covenant in that their own spiritual religious
yeah, well,
themes.
I am bridging into those. Though.
I know.
Yeah,
that's a
bridge
too far.
That's a
bridge
too far.
I was
going
to
say, if there's one blockbuster that's probably as comparably nihilistic. Alien Covenant.
And Prometheus, yeah. Well, Alien Covenant is a fantastic movie about how terrible it is to make movies today.
Mm.
It's basically Ridley Scott throwing a temper tantrum because he can't make the Prometheus sequel he wants. And it's glorious when you look at it that way.
whatever.
Fortunately, I'll never have to look at it that way. I'll never see it again.
Whatever the merits of Alien 3 may or may not
be. delicate Luke.
I'm sure I can imagine Ridley Scott watching it and being like, yes, yes. More. This is how it's meant to be.
But that's it. It is literally like it's because you look at Prometheus, and Prometheus is basically a movie about how God doesn't care about you, and you have no like reason to believe that God will offer you any vindication or purpose. And you're like, that's positively upbeat compared to what I just watched. But yeah, Alien Resurrection is still a terrible, terrible film. But anyway, let's move on to the film news. In film news this week, the Vancouver Irish Film Festival has announced. Basically, it's screenings. It'll launch in June. The first screening, which will be Saturday, 16th June, will be a screening of The Drummer and the Keeper at the beautiful Van City Theatre.
It's doing a lot of festival business.
I still
haven't seen it.
I like how you say you're almost proud. It's like
it's not. It's one of those ones I did mean to catch, and then every bloody podcast that comes up at some festival is like, shit, I still haven't seen it.
I know.
Almost like
a year from now, I'm going to be saying that. Yeah. Grace, you know, it's like, oh yeah, I should see that.
I feel like you're just angling for that precious sort of festival coverage gig. It's like if we send Jay over,
send me to Vancouver and I'll cover it.
I promise I will watch the Drummer in the
Keeper. But I'll stay in no less than 4 stars. Just to say that.
We'll negotiate there. But yeah, so there's a long history, obviously, of co-production between Canada and Ireland. We talked last week about the grant, the gender equality grant that they're doing at the moment for Canadian and Irish co-productions as well. But even previous films like, say, Brooklyn, Room, Maudie, and The Breadwinner, I believe, are also sort of overlap between the two. So that's pretty great as well. In terms of other Irish films, or other Irish film news, Maze is now available on Netflix. So if you...
I will see it. It's
charming.
I heard
it's
okay.
It's very BBC movie. It feels very much like... Remember about 10 years ago, the BBC went through a phase of making movies about Northern Ireland? So these...
Did they?
Yeah.
Not so sinister.
But
political bias.
They arrived with their cameras.
Jeremy English forgot what Northern Ireland was for 10 years, obviously.
But yeah,
well, they should have kept doing
those. I was about to say, yeah, this is why we're in this situation right now, because the BBC stopped making those. If only they kept making those.
What did they make?
They made a Bloody Sunday one that wasn't obviously the Bloody Sunday, right? If I remember correctly, didn't they do...
Yeah,
that was kind of big.
That wasn't the Nesbitt one, right?
No, not the Nesbitt one. There was another one.
There was
it's like the Robin Hood films, right?
Yeah. The two come along at once. Yeah.
Rival Bloody Sunday film. Who would have thought?
That's your like
what a world.
Your meteor films from the mid-90s, your volcano films. Yeah, yeah. It's like Bloody Sunday is so hot right now. It's that Alan Partridge moment. You know that U2 song? That's what we want right now.
Yeah. That's amazing. Yeah. Anyway, sorry.
But
I did not know that.
Maze is quite good. It's very atmospheric. It's very well directed. Tom Vaughan Lawler, who is everywhere at the moment.
He really is.
Including being mistaken for Donald Gleeson in Infinity War as well. But yeah, he's... Yeah. Yeah, I've had several people...
Only because he's under prosthetics.
Or is it prosthetic or CGI? But
well, whatever it is. But you wouldn't physically mix them up.
He's tall, skinny... Irish,
not
and
ginger,
vaguely menacing.
Yeah, not ginger is a good clue.
Yeah, that's the hint there.
Also, not attractive.
But whoa!
No, I'm not being mean. I'm just saying Donald is attractive. Tom Von Lawler, to me, anyway, is not.
All right, take
so
that.
So I would make that mistake. Mm-hmm.
All right, in terms of yeah, well then I guess that's that. But in terms of other in terms of other film news, Universal made an offer for Fox, $60 billion cash only, I believe. Yeah.
Well.
The way that you describe it as cash only makes it sound like they drove little dumpster trucks full of money. It's like there's a queue of guys here with briefcases. You got to count all of it. No, it just means no share options, I believe.
Which is the case with the Disney offer.
Yeah.
But Disney shares are kind of gold dust, so that doesn't really make a great counter offer right now.
Yeah, you can have part of like, you know, the Star Wars, Marvel stuff, or you can have just cash.
Why would you not take Disney shares? Because as soon as that sale is completed, cash out immediately.
I'll take the Disney shares. Sorry, the
so when Disney are sort of purchasing shares in Jenny. But yeah, so yeah, this is fascinating. This is basically the shrinking of the entertainment market.
It. We're seeing the future of Hollywood.
So when does Amazon buy their studio? When does Netflix buy their studio?
Netflix don't really need to.
No, they don't.
These whole studio mergers are effectively happening because of
Netflix. Yeah, of course, yeah. To kind of protect themselves.
Do they not have competition laws in the States or something?
They will all be heavily monitored and
when you pass
that, and it may, because the studios were famously broken up back in the 20s.
Yeah, because you were when they were promoting cinemas and stuff.
When they were cinemas as well.
So it may well be the case that we're going down that way.
Although, you know, it would give Trump the perfect opportunity to raise the middle finger to Amazon in some indirect way.
Would like to do that.
Yeah, he really, really would. But yeah, so that is that news anyway.
Does that news mean that we get to read a lot of great tweets about how this is great news for the film industry? The X-Men are going to join the Jurassic World universe.
They could only improve
it. You know what's terrifying is you can actually see that happening so easily. Somebody is just like, yes, I'll just keep throwing it at the board.
You delete that
from Colin Trevorrow.
Oh, it gets better. You think it's the Jurassic World universe they're going to? Oh, no.
Not the
Dark
Universe
Volume 6.
God.
Yeah, which
somehow... Is it actually still going?
No, it's dead.
There's talk of it still being on the table. But
it was the one-year anniversary
of the photo.
The photo. Which was great, the most wonderful Photoshop experience any of those actors ever had.
Hundreds of millions hemorrhaged on this nonsense.
How much did Javier Bardem get paid and he never had to do anything particularly demeaning apart from send on a photo of himself that could be Photoshopped? That's gotta be.
It's not bad, is it?
That's
gotta
be
that's
like
some good work. That's
some
good
work.
Yeah, that's not bad.
Actually, so sad when you sit and think about it.
But it was just laughed off the internet.
As soon as it happened, everybody was like, what are you doing?
There wasn't a single person who went,
finally!
Yeah, I've been waiting for this. Well, I mean, but the thing is with the Dark Universe is they tried so many times. It wasn't like...
It was the fifth go-round at that stage.
It was like the Wolfman.
Dracula Untold.
Dracula Untold. It was, and then it was the Mummy, which finally did it.
I never saw any of them, thankfully.
I saw Dracula Untold.
And?
Which was, I mean, it's not god-awful, but it's not good either.
But something described as not god awful. It's not a great starting point, though.
It was fine. It was the type of thing you probably stumble across on the TV if not,
yeah.
You might leave it on as background noise kind of thing.
It's incredible, though, because these things have historical blueprints. So they're
going
to build this dark universe. It's like, you know, this ends with Laurel and Hardy meet the Mummy. What is this what you're
Abbott
going
to Abbott and Costello meet the Mummy.
Also, plus, you could do with Laurel and Hardy one with John C. Reilly and Steve Coogan. And that film comes out. So you can actually do
that's
it. That'd be amazing. I'd watch that in a heartbeat.
And Jay has just been hired by Universal.
Finally.
It's
going to be a photo of me on Twitter later.
Yeah, this is the end game. We're planning movies up to 2027.
I'm
going to
be leaning back against somebody in another executive like that. Yeah. Which I've always wanted to do, quite frankly.
I can't wait for Joss Whedon to direct Laurel and Hardy and Wolverine.
You're hard, Luke. I've just heard you.
Universal Monsters.
Imagine
yourself
stepping out of a time machine in 10 or 12 years and just going, what the hell?
Everything will be Disney.
Like, that gift from Community in real life, everything is on fire.
But, I mean, and it's funny that the jokes about all those tweets, that seems to be the bulk of comment about the merger. It's like, no, it's not like, oh my god, we're actually, like, getting closer and closer to like corporate monopolies of absolutely everything. It's like, nope, Wolverine and the Avengers.
And Hugh Lane.
And you.
Excuse me, gentlemen. What?
I was really disappointed that Citizen Lane didn't end with a shot of WB 8 saying, you're about to become part of a much larger universe.
I'm here to
the Anglo-Irish
Initiative. The Anglo-Irish Initiative would be great. That's a great kickoff point.
Yeah. But anyway, so let's move on to something more uplifting. Let's move on to the top 10.
This is going to be
uplifting.
At number 10, Duck Duck Goose.
Really?
Have the children not gone back to school? Weeks
they're
ago.
They're almost finished school. Now.
They're almost finished school.
They're going to be
it'll get a bump. It'll stay for another 2 weeks.
I feel like I'm repeating myself here. Do they spend any time learning? Just at the cinema all the time.
This has been here for weeks.
Crescent grandfather Ronan has weighed in here.
Yeah. This has earned €625,000, despite the fact that... I say that like we're super important. Despite the fact that we've never seen it. But despite the fact that it seemed to have crept in under the collective radar and earned that much money.
I feel like this country keeps like bad kids movies going. Like it's
not this country.
Industry
every country. Like
this one in particular.
They do well here. They do very well here.
But don't worry. I mean, clearly it's the only terrible kids movie in the top 10. At number 9, Peter Rabbit.
At number 8.
that's 3.2 million to date.
That's quite better.
That's a little bit better. Okay, at number 8, A Quiet Place, which has earned $300 million worldwide.
Jesus.
Phenomenal. Great. The best thing, like, I believe it's Paramount's first quarterly profit in 4 years.
Oh, jeez. They're having a very small bottle of champagne.
They're like,
It's been in the drawer for a while.
There you go.
Each of you can have one item from the hotel minibar. Choose carefully.
You know they're sat around the table going, how do we make a scene?
Oh, that's already in production. I'm going back to that. Some slack loads of money I
can
see. Can they not see this time? What do we do?
You say that as if like there's not a Quiet Place shared universe in effect. Already, they're already
mapping it.
County foe monster.
Quiet universe.
Like the success of films like The Quiet Place really just underlines how stupid the whole dark universe thing was, because horror films make money.
Yeah.
They
yeah.
always make
How
money.
Could you mess that up?
If you have horror characters and then say, we're going to make a series of interconnected action adventure films. Like Dracula.
What if Dracula
the Mummy.
But Lord of the Rings? What if The Mummy but a Tom Cruise film?
Yeah.
Yeah. If they did a series of films that weren't connected, that were just
straight up horror.
Mid to low budget.
Which horror is
Dracula
terrible.
Films
yeah.
Or films with The Mummy or whatever. It would have worked.
Plus they could have brought them together into a gory horror film if you wanted later on. If you wanted to just kind of separate and all of it, like you could have done it. Do you know what I mean? Or else it could have made a fortune
yeah.
at that stage.
It would have worked like it did for the same studio decades ago.
Yeah. But yeah, so Quiet Place is good. The great success story for Paramount, which is kind of sad when you think about it, because obviously they've had
Mission Impossible coming. That'll sort
them out. That will sort them out. And Bumblebee, don't forget
Bumblebee. Oh, I've forgotten Bumblebee.
Can we forget
what?
Bumblebee?
What is Bumblebee?
It's
don't ask.
Oh wait, no, is this a Transformers movie?
Yes.
Yeah.
Right.
Transformers solo movie.
Really? Yeah, the guy who runs like a studio as a director.
Not Henry Selick. Okay.
No.
Wow.
One for you, one for me, I think.
Okay.
To keep,
is this the one for
him? To
keep
the lights on.
Okay.
This is his passion project.
Yeah.
For you,
he's been
knocking on the door.
I remember when Seven drawn the bumblebee on a piece of paper off of the lower
gun. Okay, so I'm actually now looking forward to that more.
Stop it.
Okay.
Stop it.
I will probably see
but
that.
You say that as if you were looking forward to it a certain amount.
It's like, now
it's increased by
20%. Yeah. Darren stays neutral about everything until he sees them.
At number 7, it's Tully.
I haven't seen it. I heard good things.
I have seen it.
Yes.
I just put up a review on Film in Dublin today about Tully, actually. I really liked it a lot. I think it's a very interesting film. Now, I've seen by Diablo Cody and Jason Reitman, I've seen Juno and I've seen Young Adult. Juno, I think, maybe hasn't aged great in some areas, but I still think there's good quality to that film. Young Adult, I really like.
Me too. It's pretty great.
A kind of underseen gem. Tully is. It's got a fantastic performance by Charlize Theron. I think it's kind of slyly and darkly comedic. I think Diablo Cody. She gets across that portrayal of motherhood kind of honestly. It's not overly dark, but it is kind of honest about some of the negative things that can come from a parent that kind of has a lot on their plate.
Well, the pressures and expectations imposed on mothers, basically.
Yeah, so I mean, if there are other people that are listening that haven't seen it, Tully is about a mother, Marlo. She's in a family with two children and her husband, Ron Livingston.
Not the character, not the...
the actor.
Ron Livingston playing himself.
There's a third child on the way. They're kind of, they're doing okay, but like any family, they have their struggles. Their son has some kind of unspecified disorder they don't know yet, and kind of everybody refers to him as quirky, which grates on Charlize Theron, as you might imagine. And her brother, who is played by Mark Duplass,
which somehow I'm not playing Ron Livingston's brother,
he says to help take the pressure off, he will pay for a night nanny for her, someone to come when the baby comes to look after the child only at night, and she ends up taking them up on it, and that is Tully, played by Mackenzie Davis, and kind of it takes the relationship between Marlo and Tully in this unexpected direction. It might be controversial, the direction that it takes them in, but I thought it was really interesting, and I thought it was really had a lot to kind of say about the person that you kind of leave behind when you become a parent, and kind of the person that you become when you become a parent. I thought it was very good. I'd say definitely watch it.
Yeah, I enjoyed it as well. I thought it was surprisingly heartwarming, because again, going into it, everyone was like, this is a really... And again, keep in mind, I opened the podcast by recommending Alien 3.
Yes.
So my threshold for darkness and bleakness may be significantly higher. But I was going into it expecting and dreading, because I've heard a lot that it's a very dark movie. And it is honest, and it is frank about these things, but it's surprisingly humanist in places. It's very endearing. It's got a warmth to it at its core, which surprised me. Particularly when you think of Diablo Cody and Charlize Theron collaborating on Young Adult, which I agree with you is underseen, but it's one of the bleakest,
much
darkest
darker,
indie
yes.
movies.
And I was concerned that this would be darker.
Yeah. I was actually quite worried about it.
I think Cody is a screenwriter that I think people dismissed a lot after the backlash to Juno. I think if Juno came a couple of years later, when social media was even more of a thing, I think the backlash would have been even harder.
Yeah.
It's just how things kind of go now, but I think we don't acknowledge sometimes that people can improve even once we know who they are. You know, I think that Cody has improved as she's gone on. And Juno is still a good screenplay, but I think that her screenplays have gotten better.
I'm still quite fond of Juno. I admit that it is probably not aged particularly well, but I still have a very soft spot for it.
In dialogue, maybe, not in themes, I don't think. I think what the film is saying, I think it does as well as ever. I think the characters in Juno are really great. I think Honest to Blog and Hamburger Phones are maybe a little dated.
Hey, Hamburger Phones are still cool. At number six, it's Breaking In, which is Gabrielle Union and Bad Billy Burke. It's a movie in which a mother is forced to break into her own house in order to rescue her children from a bunch of sinister robbers. It's Panic Room in reverse, or even the second act of Panic Room, basically.
What if the robbers lock themselves in?
Confused. It's like, yeah. The keys were very confusing. It was really awkward. I haven't seen the movie.
We don't even spoil it to her own, do we? Do we? Save the suspense when you're in the cinema.
Yeah.
Which I will be very soon, based on that.
That description there. Come on, doesn't it sound fun?
It looks like it has potential.
It has sort of a... feels like a kind of a pulpy TV movie, sort of like a Thursday night sort of, sit down, watch, enjoy, don't think too much about it. At number five, it's Life of the Party, written and directed by Ben Falcone, written by and starring Melissa McCarthy, which is about a woman who goes back to college following her divorce or separation. I have not seen this.
No.
All right.
No.
No. I feel very out of the loop, like, because all I've been doing this past month is thinking about certain reference.
Yeah.
Like, what else is going on in the world?
Oh yeah,
all these movies are already out.
Pop culture, but don't worry. By the time that you listen to this, it will all be over.
It kind of reminds me of old school, but obviously that came out like 20 years ago. It takes 20 years for them to go, but what if a woman?
How crazy would that be?
Hang on a second. Old school came about 20 years ago.
Old school's 15 years
old
ago.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Jesus fucking Christ.
It's pretty close.
Yeah.
It's coming up on 20 years.
I loved it when I was a teenager.
I was okay.
Never mind. Yes. At number four, I Feel Pretty, which is holding on remarkably well. It's earned €639,000 to date at the Irish box office. Took another 78 this weekend.
That's the Amy Schumer one, isn't it?
That's the Amy Schumer one.
It's a serious box office draw still.
Yeah, I
think she has name recognition. Which
yeah, because
not a lot of people do among the wider
true.
Masses, so to speak.
Yeah.
But it's kind of interesting. Because outside of Trainwreck, so obviously like Snatched and this are very much conventional comedies in a way. They're not like on brand for her, in that like this is a movie, and I think one of the issues with the movie, at least for me, was that it's torn between being a standard self-actualization tale, as most comedies have to be, about a woman who is allegedly ugly, but who thinks of herself as ugly, who has basically wakes up and thinks she's pretty. The twist being, she hasn't actually gone through the body transformation that you associate with movies like Big. So you have this really, really awful, mean-spirited sense the joke is on her. It's like, look at this ugly person, in inverted commas, who thinks that they're pretty. How crazy is that? Isn't that hilarious? And it's really mean, while also trying to be really life-affirming. And it doesn't balance those tones well at all. It's not a good film, unfortunately. Which is a shame.
It does separate. She is great. I like her. She's got real screen presence and she's got good comedy skills.
Yeah,
but this sounds a bit...
It's very conventional. It's very safe. Mm. I miss... Like, Trainwreck was... I know I like Trainwreck more than you do.
I
think it's far too
quite like Trainwreck, yeah.
But
it's like a lot of those films with 40 minutes long.
Yeah.
But I did enjoy it, though.
And it's got her own voice in it.
That's the thing. I didn't like Trainwreck very much.
But it is. It's interesting.
Yeah.
There's something interesting going on with it.
Yeah, as opposed to this, which is big, but what if we got to laugh at the person and it was Amy Schumer?
It's so cruel.
It really is. It's very
mean.
Why are
we so mean?
But Ronan, this next one will cheer you up.
Well, then.
Sherlock Gnomes. You're wondering about the kids.
I swear to God, it's the most depressing part of this podcast.
What,
every single week you read out the top 10 and we're just like, really?
Yeah. Oh, come on. Tell me you're not excited about gnome-related pun movies. Gnome on the Range.
I have no problem with Sherlock Gnomes, but it's just, you know, sometimes these movies come out and it's like, literally nothing to say about this. It's just a movie.
It is.
That is another film that's in the top 10.
That is also.
It's a thing that exists.
Yeah, it's earned almost half a million. It's on €440,000 to date, taking 120 this weekend. So yeah, it's there, and it's probably going to be there a while.
See,
unless we can think of a family-friendly movie that's being released this weekend, possibly animation, that might possibly challenge it. I don't think we can.
I know I can't either. This way, I don't have kids. I don't have to go try to see Sherlock Holmes.
You can, if you're a good parent, you can choose well. You can go and see Coco.
Yeah, but if you're a bad parent, you can go see Sherlock Holmes.
You can't see Coco now.
But you have no control over whether your kids will have crap taste or not.
Yeah,
true.
Yeah, you
no,
do.
Like
you
every,
them Bird
every
and
time
films
you try to show them
seven.
Something great, they're still going to want to watch like Cars 4 million times.
Sit down and make them watch Battle of Algiers. It's like, kids, this is how you learn.
Colonialism.
Yeah.
Your first word.
That's it, yeah.
Is this the second or third Gnome on Juliet?
Second film.
Okay, because it feels
thing?
Like there's a lot more.
Well,
it's good. Really good.
It
feels
right
like
Gnome Alone.
I swear I heard about Sherlock Gnomes. 3 or 4 years ago.
The man with no name? I mean, come on, they write themselves. I mean, come on. If Jay wants
Dr. Gnome?
Jay wants his shared universe.
I do.
Want your you want your monster movie shared universe. I want to be the guy sitting in the pitch room with the gnome puns.
Darren, you
that's
come in, you can pitch anytime to me. I'll be in the studio ready to take your pitch.
At number two, Avengers Infinity War, still hanging on in there, having earned €4.3 million at the box office today.
Jesus,
so much more
something tells me it's going to be there for a while.
I suspect it's going to be there for a while. Another 172,000 this weekend. It's a monster, obviously knocked off for the first time. I wonder if we could take any guesses what will be at number one. But yeah, it's still earning. And it's probably going to still be earning for quite a while.
I will see it at some point, probably this weekend.
Well, we do have to take it in 4DX.
We'll keep going in this conversation.
We'll continue this later. And then at number one, the movie that knocked Infinity War off the top pole, off the pole position, it's Deadpool 2.
Haven't seen it yet. I'm going to see it next week. I like Deadpool 1. I think Deadpool is the character that can wear it. He's welcome, depending on how much of him you've seen. I might enjoy Deadpool 2. I think maybe Deadpool 3 which are definitely going to come out, might be where they start to lose people.
Was it something like 39% of the US box office to date so far this year has been earned by superhero movies between Black Panther, Infinity War, and this? Last year, I think statistic was somewhere around 19%, and the year before it was 17%.
That's really depressing.
They've put so much money into the promotion for Deadpool 2, though. Which is
so needy.
Because did they need to? Like,
I've
seen things where they've taken films by the same studio and they've gone to like the DVD rack and they've like put Deadpool
on the cover of them. Selling those DVDs, though. That's not selling Deadpool.
It's
still both there.
But this is
Deadpool is all over my Instagram.
It's horrid. It's absolutely horrid. It's everywhere. Like.
You make it sound as if there's a sentient character there and not a marketing team.
He's very ubiquitous, I think, and funny because it's like I mean the first film was fine, but I'm almost too cynical for how cynical it is. And nothing about it really did anything for me, and I can't understand how it became such a massive
exhausting.
Yeah, it was a bit exhausting.
I feel really terrible. This is Darren again continuing his theme of nihilism. Isn't it fantastic? Where I was like, actually, I thought Deadpool was really sweet and touching. I thought that it had this like really sweet core. It's basically a love story. It's a very conventional superhero story. Same thing with Deadpool 2. They're very conventional action narratives. They're very much the action narratives that predate superhero movies. They're 80s action movies in many ways, shape, and form. They're just delivered with a tiny sprinkling of self-awareness. And the issue with Deadpool 2 is that level of self-awareness isn't nearly high enough. I mean, there's something that happens before the teasers, before the opening credits, which is horribly ill-judged and shows that the writers really have no idea what they're doing per se. They haven't clearly haven't thought through the, like, what it actually means to be telling the story that they're telling. And it's horribly ill-judged, and it's like, if this is a self-aware superhero movie, it's clearly not as self-aware as it thinks it is. But at the same time,
have, anything to do with the interview the writers gave recently,
yes,
where there was a particular trope in comic book lore which they claim to have never been overlooked.
Yes, involving a kitchen appliance.
Yes.
And whether or not people put somebody.
Completely lost. I have no idea.
Well,
mine
is
racing.
Trying
to find
you.
I
are
know exactly what you're talking about.
And
when I saw that interview, no, I didn't read it because I hadn't seen the film yet, but when I.
You knew exactly where
it
was
getting
at.
That
I feel very old right now. What the hell is going on?
Okay.
Kitchen appliance gender trope. Think about it.
Okay.
Think about it.
In 1995, Jay, Kyle Rayner, the Green Lantern, came home to discover that his archenemy, Major Force, had shoved his girlfriend into a fridge. Henceforth, Gail Simone invented the term fridging to refer to the story beat where a female character was fridged or disposed of or murdered or violated or assaulted in order to motivate the male character in question. John Wick, for example, obviously does it with the dog, but there are countless other examples.
Okay, I just, I type. Okay, that doesn't really seem screen kitchen implement to me, but okay, I'll take your
point. The following fridge?
Yes, but if you suddenly implement
it gets better, though. The following year, the character returned and tried to one-up himself by shoving Green Lantern's mother into an oven. But that's a different topic for the conversation.
Fridging to me just makes me think of that Tomb Raider game where you put the butler in the fridge.
It's kind of like that, but also misogynist. So if you can imagine that, but like as systemic misogyny.
I can see that on the poster now.
Yeah. Like Tomb Raider 2, but with systemic misogyny.
I would agree with you, Darren, about the first Deadpool, though. I think it did try to give it that bit of heart.
Yeah.
And I think that stood to it. And, you know, I think Deadpool's a funny character in certain doses.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, hopefully, having not seen the film, hopefully Deadpool 2 carries that. The interviews and the stuff about fridging that I've heard doesn't make me hopeful, but I think I thought Deadpool was a funny film. I think in the comics that bit of heart is important for Deadpool to have as well, because he can be a tiresome character.
Yeah.
In the comics, you know, kind of the wave broke back on Deadpool, and I think that will happen as well.
Yeah.
The problem I have is, like, I already exhausted by the character just on advertisement alone.
Yeah.
Like the idea of going to see a 2-hour film after watching him turn up at David Beckham's house and all the various other things that I've seen. It is exhausting.
Well,
I don't care.
He met Saxicon
of
Helium.
That is the fact that, like, Ryan Reynolds seems to be playing Deadpool every day of his life. Like,
yeah.
Everything he tweets, everything.
It's exhausting.
Like,
I find all the exhausting.
So,
yeah.
it feels like you're just kind of listening to it constantly.
I feel deadened by it. I feel I'm numb to the idea, but then it's like, I'm going to see the film. I feel like I've seen the film already. And I'm
living in the film.
Yeah.
Really weird, because I was able to block most of that out. I've seen the Bob Ross poster. I only discovered the horrible depths of the advertising afterwards, when I was like, wait a minute. So he sold coffee beans. That's interesting.
They should have put Deadpool onto the cover of, like, the
GQ.
Deadpool,
yeah.
The Dirty Harry film.
That would have been the obvious. But yeah, so I actually quite enjoyed it. It's a very simple film. It's a film very much about, in the way that most modern blockbusters are, family. But it's a very simple narrative arc, very simple thematic arc, very clear character objectives. Like, after Infinity War, which was a movie where I think none of the characters really had motivation or agency, the idea of doing a very simple and straightforward movie in which characters have very simple motivations is not a bad thing.
Yeah.
And I quite appreciated the simplicity of it. I don't think it's brilliant. It won't be on my top 10 at the end of the year. It won't probably won't even be my favourite superhero movie of the year, because it already isn't. But it's perfectly serviceable.
Jesus, Darren, that is not selling it. You don't put perfectly serviceable on a poster.
It doesn't need selling, clearly.
Yeah, well, I mean...
But to people like me, it does.
Well, Jay, we're going to see it in 4DX anyway, so it's
all
good.
That's true.
So.
Is TJ Miller in this one as well?
Yes.
Unfortunately,
yeah.
Yeah, no.
Anyway...
Yeah, there's another reason not to see it.
So let's take a look at what's coming out this week. So what might possibly topple the movies that we just talked about?
Hit me with it.
Okay. Show Dogs.
I have no idea what Show Dogs is.
I have a funny story about it, but you go.
No, you go.
Yes,
did I read some of the Show Dogs today?
Yes.
Yes, you did.
Is that the same thing everybody else is referencing
yes.
here? Is that
yeah.
what it is? Okay.
So who wants to go?
I
go
don't
on,
know. I
go.
Don't even want to discuss it.
There's controversy over Show Dogs. It's had to go back into the editing room.
Have a soft edit.
Yes. Because there are scenes... Okay, so Show Dogs is is Miss Congeniality, but with talking dogs.
Shit, that sounds amazing.
Starring Will Arnett, Ludacris, Stanley Tucci, and Shaquille O'Neal.
Stanley Tucci?
Shaquille O'Neal, ladies and gentlemen.
Sorry, Stanley Tucci.
So, yes.
Right, Ronan, we're going to see this.
There's no women.
Apparently,
everything
else.
Okay. Yeah,
I just have the information on the screen in front of me.
So, Ludacris Bridges voices a police dog that has to go and enter a show dog competition because
this sounds incredible.
Panda that's been
the
kidnapped.
Citizen, the panda, the citizen.
It's being trafficked through the.
I feel like you're taking too much thought.
Yeah.
This is like Gabriel breaking your throne out.
Because he's being entered in the show dog competition, at one point he has to be checked.
In case you can't see, listeners, Luke is making a gesture in which he puts his palm upwards and cups.
Yes.
His testicles have to be checked. And he doesn't consent to this, and he's told to imagine that he's somewhere else. Like, it is... You know, all jokes aside, it is
weird.
Weird.
Everything about this is weird.
There are children's films that do have this weirdly and unnecessarily
juvenile humor about
sexual weird element to them. And,
but like this sexual element is like what, like, you know, the sexual element in other films is like something for daddy, as creepy as that is already. But this is something for daddy, which is already creepy. But with dogs, which is somehow even creepier.
Who are you selling this to?
Yeah.
That's right. What?
So,
this
is a kid's movie.
This is a kid's movie, and that's why there's been a complaint, because I think parents' councils or some kind of parents' group
had to explain this to their kids.
They saw it as harmful for children to see, the whole idea of just imagining yourself. You know, they objected to that. So it's gone back to
They objected to that on the grounds that it may teach people how to abuse children, because that's apparently how you abuse children. It's when you're doing it, you ask them to think of something else. So apparently somebody who saw this made that connection and was like, well, you probably shouldn't put that in your family movie.
That's fair.
incredulity.
So trite, it's a film about dogs, but...
Yeah.
This doesn't need to be in a film for children, so why is it there?
Yeah, why was it there in the first place is the question.
Probably it's got 20 writers. And...
Two of them thought this was hilarious.
Yeah.
And the other 18 didn't have enough leverage to get
it. It's just gross, take it out.
Yeah. On the note of it's just gross, take it out, On Chesil Beach is opening this week as well.
That is the best segue you have ever. Thank you. That is inspired.
Thank you. I'm here. I work very, very well.
It's gross. Take it out of the film.
Yeah,
that's
pretty much. So I've seen this. I think Roland, have you seen?
No,
have you read the book?
I've read the book.
Yeah, I thought the film was okay. It's a film that I suspect. I think you've mentioned before. Very tough to adapt. You suspect?
Yeah, well, I think it's internalized. It's all about the way that people think within their own heads.
Yeah.
And don't interact and don't communicate to each other, and expect one thing but aren't able to verbalize their expectations, and it's all about the tensions in that. So I'm really fascinated to see how it works.
Not well. it's grand, it's interesting. There are two really great performances from Saoirse Ronan and Samuel West, who play these characters who are on their honeymoon on Chesil Beach, who basically the film then travels back through their various lives and sort of like tries to put together this sort of like fracture picture of who they are and how they came to be, and to explain this weird neuroses that they both have building up to what you would imagine that a wedding night would build up to and the catastrophic consequences thereof. And it's interesting, it's not necessarily good, and there's a sense, and this is interesting because it was written by Ian McEwan adapting his own novel, but it feels very clumsy in how it translates its ideas to screen. In particular, and again, I'm not going to get spoilery here, but it has two separate codas, neither of which is really necessary.
I heard
but
there
one
problems at the end.
One would have sufficed if you absolutely had to do it. You don't need two of them. And there's something also, and I don't know how it worked in prose. Maybe it worked better in prose, but there's something kind of tasteless in the way that it sort of reduces its characters to like Freudian riddles to be solved.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like a whodunit. But with like asexuality, which is kind of creepy. It's like this is a problem and there's a root cause, and this is what the movie is inviting the audience to sort of untwirl that. And it feels, obviously cinema is voyeuristic as an art form, but this feels really weird and voyeuristic because it's presenting itself as a prestige drama with a very earnest center, and it's like, this is a very important emotional issue, and you're like, which is kind of creepy how fixated you are on this. But Saoirse Ronan's fantastic, and West is great as well. And I mean, it's interesting.
It feels like it's been on the verge of coming out for about 3 or 4 years
now.
It's been held back.
They started adapting their way back, and they had trouble for whatever reason. I think essentially they wound up, to a certain extent, waiting for Saoirse Ronan to be old enough for the role.
Oh, okay.
Because Ian McEwan knew her from Atonement and just thought she's a fantastic actress.
Well, she is.
Old enough for the role.
No doubt.
It's really interesting because I think actually Atonement is a really good example of, obviously it wasn't written, the film wasn't written by McEwan, but it's a really literary book. It's, you know, it's a meta novel in that it's all about the idea of novels and literature and believing what you read and
stories offering resolution,
collapsing into the all this sort of thing, the very idea of narrative. And there's a really fascinating scene in Atonement, the film, where they watch, I think it's a Renoir film, or there's a Renoir film in the background. It's one of the few deviations from the novel, and it sort of intrinsically understands the difference between the media. So I'm really, really fascinated to see this, especially because it's adapted by McEwan, because obviously he's one of the great English language novelists working today. And Unjust Leech is a terrific novel. I love it.
Yeah,
it's
great.
One of his best works. It's so contained.
I've read it, but I really like it.
It's a novella, isn't it?
Yeah,
you read it in one sitting. And it's absolutely concerned with the idea of the way people don't express themselves.
Yes.
And translating that to cinema is really, really difficult. And from what you're saying, it sounds like it doesn't entirely work. And I'm really fascinated to see how he would do that himself. Because he's written screenplays before. I've seen the other films he's written, which are adapted from other people's books, actually. Actually, they're not terribly interesting. So I think he's maybe not a great scriptwriter. He doesn't necessarily understand cinema as well as he understands literature.
Dare he only be talented?
It might be as well that you probably shouldn't maybe adapt your own book as well to some degree. Maybe not for everyone like that.
Kill your darling.
Yeah, exactly. Then we get out of the problem with that.
Cool. Also out this week, the big Irish release of the week is The Breadwinner, Nora Toomey's adaptation of the book.
Yeah.
I think I've seen this. I know Jay
has
seen
this.
I saw it, yeah.
Yeah. So I quite like this.
I like it.
I like it
a
lot.
Good.
It's really, really moving. It's basically set in Afghanistan during the reign of the Taliban, following a young girl who basically has to take care of her family. And it becomes this wonderful story about stories, and about how stories inspire us, and about how stories bind us together, and how stories give us the strength to survive in impossible situations. And they almost nourish us in the style of The Breadwinner of the title. It's absolutely beautiful. It's a cartoon saloon movie, so it's got this...
You'll have an idea of what it looks like if you've seen anything else in there.
Stunning.
Yeah.
It's absolutely beautiful. I mean, they did some of the scenes, Secret of Kells, which are beautiful animations, but... And I mean, I will admit that I like it, I think, more than Jay does, but I think this is their best film by some considerable distance. It's absolutely beautiful.
I really like it, but I think I'd decide first I would see, but I mean, I can see the either art. It's not necessarily massively kind of controversial like one of the other, though I think they're both pretty strong. We discussed this earlier a little bit, Darren, about the release The Breadwinner, which is coming out the week of a referendum against two blockbusters in the cinema.
Well, this is the thing where you and I, we agreed broadly speaking.
Yeah.
And again, this is a situation that happened with both Secret of Kells and with, obviously, Song of the Sea, where these movies don't necessarily attract a school-age audience.
Particularly this one, which is...
pretty bleak.
Yeah, it's not necessarily...
So I
love it. It's not a kid's... It is a kid's film. Like, kids can see it.
Yeah.
But it's not necessarily a kid's film in the broad way that...
Kids when you're comparing
kids.
It to Show Dogs,
well,
you imagine
the context will lend itself more to an adult audience.
I think slightly older children, anybody from around kind of 8, 9, 10 years old and are both that, would certainly get a bit more out of it. Like, but you could bring small children, but you could if you want to,
but
they're not going to get anything from it. Probably get more of it.
I don't think so. I think, you know, if you look at, say, Persepolis as one end of the spectrum, I think it's maybe falling in the middle of that.
Yes, I agree.
More children's films, I think maybe older children maybe would enjoy it, but younger children.
The thing of it is, though,
I think it's a really wonderful film, but I don't know that young children would get much out of it.
We were talking about the Oscar nomination that I got.
This should be more like Call Me By Your Name than Coco. This is like, they should be aiming for
a
distribution that it basically aspires to capitalize on the Oscar nomination and accept that you're not going to win the 18, you know, the 8 to 18 crowd. You're going to get the Arthouse crowd.
You want the Spirited Away crowd, don't you?
Yeah,
the Oscar nominated prestige animated film.
Yeah.
It's Angelina Jolie backed as well, so you've got a name to kind of put behind it as well.
Now, I am wary of being too instructive, being all like, oh, well, we should let us.
No, but you've done this before, and the films haven't done very well at the box office, and I think the films are good, so there's a distribution issue clearly there that like it's probably not going to do a lot of business this weekend, although people should see it if they can, because it's really good.
In terms of, like, we went through the top 10 includes like Duck Duck Goose, Sherlock Gnomes, will contain Show Dogs, it has Peter Rabbit. Like, there's no market space there for anything. On top of the three blockbusters that are going to take up three of the spaces anyway, the one studio comedy, and potentially, you know, anything else, a random wild
card. Plus, it's going to be 25 degrees at the weekend.
And The Greatest Showman. Interesting enough, actually, I was thinking of this with the release of the referendum. I'm surprised that the marketing here didn't, and I don't want to say capitalize on it,
because
it's very
mean,
cynical.
No.
But, like, this should be, in theory, the perfect moment for a movie about a young girl asserting her right to exist.
Plus directed by an Irish female director.
Yeah, that's exactly.
Yeah.
In a world where she's like oppressed, in a world where basically this is militant theocracy is taken over. I feel like it isn't maybe a stretch to market that.
Take a degree of bravery to market it that way, though, because people are always going to run miles in the opposite direction. Mm-hmm.
But
a lot of issues, but especially this one.
Yeah, but at least then they'd know the film existed, I think, which is the issue. Like, I've seen very few billboards, very few advertisements for it. Mm-hmm.
I didn't even know it was being released, really, until a couple of days ago. Only because I've seen something on Twitter with Narutumi interview with somebody.
With The Guardian,
that's
great.
As
you previously raised, it's been on Netflix US for months.
I mean,
to which a lot of people have access.
Yeah. And that's a problem. Like, I mean, the film was ready and in festivals, 10 months ago?
Yeah.
Madness, like. It's absolute madness to be doing it. I just don't get it.
Distribution schedules are so outdated. Like, they're just, they haven't really adapted, and this isn't news or anything, but they haven't adapted to come with
a perfect
new technologies and the new
realities. I mean, Netflix Windows is a perfect example of that. Like, they had this kind of post-Oscar midtermy kind of thing where they might have got a run from the kind of art house crowd into maybe the older kids skewing into the kind of February, March, as you mentioned earlier, which would have been perfect.
I mean, you probably have a better chance for this while the kids are in school, because at least then you can pitch it as something educational.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it is educational, like, in that regard. But it's
and I mean, I don't mean that in a bad way.
It's entertaining as well. Like, it's well made.
It's clever,
yeah.
It's beautifully made, it's very well written, and it's absolutely stunning.
It's just a pity, that's all.
Yeah. But don't worry, we're going to move on to another film that I'm sure Jay didn't realize was being released this week.
Yes.
Solo. And Grace, I believe you saw it this evening, or last night.
I did. Am I the only one who's seen it?
I was there last
night. Jesus, it's just me and Roland again.
All of us together, Jay.
Indeed.
I really liked it. I mean, I have to admit, I was not expecting to be particularly enthused by this movie, because I had absolutely no interest in it when it was announced, or even after half the casting was made, but after my feelings on the last Star Wars movie, which I think everyone here is well aware of, I suddenly found myself thinking I would actually like to see a Star Wars movie this year, and lo and behold, Solo has come along. But I liked it a lot more than I expected. In fact, I kind of loved it, to be honest. It was just, it's very fun, very silly, it's just entertaining, I think. And it's gas, really, because I think we're all aware of the directorial kerfuffle behind it and all the stories about the directors being former directors. Being sacked and Ron Howard being brought in, and I don't think that you feel that conflict very much in the finished product, whereas I felt in Rogue One, for instance, which had the same similar directorial issues, you could tell that had been chopped to bits and sewed back together.
Well, the issue with this is this was between 70 and 90% shot, as opposed to Rogue One.
70 and 90%?
Between 70 to 90%, depending on who you listen to.
So you've got a Ron Howard film.
It is
film
a Ron Howard film.
Yeah.
And I'm a big Ron Howard fan.
It's a very, very Ron Howard film.
It is.
Very
Jay will love it.
Oh, well, then, I'm going with that.
It's competent, it's well made,
it's
always, you're always aware of Ron Howard's
are
in a shot.
There's no flair.
But that's Ron Howard, though.
Yeah. But I mean, I don't think that's a bad thing.
It is.
I mean, I think it's...
I know. Sorry, Grace.
For this movie, anyway, I think for me, it's a relatively loving ode to what I associate with old Star Wars movies. Anyway, I'm not sure what other people, maybe your mileage may vary, but it has, earnesty to it, but it's also not taking itself too seriously. And that for me, it works. And I think Alden Ehrenreich of the ridiculous names.
Like Ansel Elgort, they should make a buddy comedy together.
Yeah. I think he does a brilliant job as solo, maybe like as Han Solo. Even he, like what we were talking about earlier with the character being just this kind of hapless Egypt in a very lovable way, who's always kind of a reluctant hero and sort of bumbles into doing the right thing. They portray him in that way in the film, and I think Ehrenreich's portrayal very much captures that sort of boyish essence in a way that's not, it's not charming, because charming seems, it's the wrong word for him, it's cute, it's endearing.
What I actually found interesting about his performance is that while Donald Glover, who's playing Lando, sort of eases in and out of a Billy Dee Williams impersonation, and he's very good at that.
He's very underwhelming in this, though.
What?
It's like, for me, Lando, the character of Lando in this is very underwhelming, because I know a lot of people might have expected someone like Donald Glover, who is very charismatic and very good, to walk away with the film, and he's kind of just there. He doesn't really, not for me anyway, he doesn't really do anything.
I thought he was one of the better parts of the film, but like the distinction is between him and, I'll call him A.E. because there's no way I'm trying that.
My sister calls him Algernon.
Algernon, okay. So Algernon.
Algernon is his name now.
So yes, Algernon. What his performance, what I really like about his performance is that it's not an impersonation.
Yeah.
It's not him doing his, like, you know, celebrity impression of Harrison Ford. In fact, it probably airs closer to Jack Nicholson, which is an interesting approach on the character. I like that now Ronan's head is like, I'm suddenly interested.
No, I was always in there for Ronan, right?
Yeah.
After Hail Caesar, I'll watch it.
Yeah, but
fantastic.
He feels like Hail Caesar's an audition for that part.
But he is really good, and it's something very sort of 70s New Hollywood about his performance without being a direct carbon copy, which I really appreciate about it. But what about yourself?
I was mixed to negative on it, to be honest. The things that I do think work about it, I would agree with Grace. I think that he's very well cast as Han Solo. I think he's very good in that part. He's very funny and very watchable. Like, he carries that film. I thought this story kind of, it didn't feel very vital to me. It just kind of,
it's
a side film. An episodic kind of thing, but it didn't.
It's
really,
Magnificent Seven becomes Wages of Fear, becomes The Great Train Robbery, becomes, you know, every other film ever.
Yeah, it kind of felt meandering to me in some ways, and I don't think it was. It never felt particularly necessary. I didn't think that it provided any kind of great insight into Han Solo as a character, or kind of add a great deal to that universe. That might be what they want to do, but I just never. Only in fits and bursts did I feel like this is a film I would say that you have to go out and see.
Yeah.
But I am in the cred that really liked The Last Jedi. I think from what I've read.
I'm
higher up than everyone else in the room. I really, really like that a lot. I think a lot of Star Wars fans are skeptical about this because they're skeptical about Star Wars in general at the moment.
This
but
had
I
a 5.6 on IMDb, which was one-tenth of a point higher than the Ewok movies, the same rating as Baywatch, and lower than Justice League.
But I think that if people...
It currently is bumped up to 6.4. But yesterday when they announced the score, they had to take the score down for a couple of days because obviously Star Wars fans get very passionate about giving films one star.
But I think if those people that didn't like The Last Jedi gave this film a chance, I think that they would like it, for the reasons that you said.
Counterpoint, this is the movie in which, like, everybody got really upset at The Last Jedi for suggesting Luke was fallible and human and had, like, mistakes and stuff. This is the movie that confirms Luke is effectively a slave owner.
Luke?
Yeah. Oh. Because droids are slaves.
Oh, sorry.
It's not always been in...
That's always been the case. I know, I'm joking.
It really does put... there's that whole droid revolution aspect of it, which it kind of plays entirely for laughs.
Yeah.
I actually quite like that sequence. Phoebe Waller-Bridge was quite good in that part. And
I thought she was great.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah, Jen, she's great.
If anyone has charisma in this movie, she does.
Yeah.
She's not even physical. Yeah. Well, like, her likeness is not on screen. So.
In terms of being kind of a charismatic rogue that everybody
somebody
can get with.
Yeah.
An L3 robot.
Comes in and has, like, energy, like actual energy and dynamism to her performance.
Yeah, so, I mean, there were parts of it that I did like, but just as a story, I don't think it quite came together. I think the kind of Han Solo as a, pining character with a doomed romance, I didn't really feel that worked very well at all.
I,
I think there's a missed opportunity there, though, I think, because something that really struck me from this, and this is not really giving anything away, but there's a lot of parallels between the way they imply Han grew up and the way Rey is portrayed as having grown up in Force Awakens. And that's something that, you know, in Force Awakens was used to bring a lot of pathos to the movie, I think a lot of poignancy to it. And in this, they kind of just shuffle it off super quickly instead of using it as a launching pad to go into something a bit more interesting. I think that felt like a bit of a shame to me.
Yeah.
And then in the sense of there being a romance aspect to it, like, that type of romance fits my interpretation of Han as a character, but it doesn't have any real weight to it because the female half of that, which is played by Emilia Clarke, that's her name, is so completely underwritten that, you know, she's not really a character. I think if you got more insight into her, then there might be more weight to that romance, but you don't really learn that much about who she is.
I definitely agree. And again, without giving too much away, I think it kind of, at the very last minute, gives a bit more, but it's a little too late, I would say, for that character.
The one bit where, like, her character has a moment and there's something just very random that happens that had literally all of us going, what's happening here? And then it just kind of is gone.
But it also, that moment, without getting too specific, is also kind of overshadowed by being incredibly pandering and fanservice-y.
Yeah.
And
that distracted me. That was, like, because I was all on board. I was like, this is a really good character. Like, I'm kind of with Luke for most of the film. I think the first two acts of the film are fairly conventional. They're not good. They're not bad. They're there. They're well-made. Like, Howard can direct. Howard knows how to manage a production. Like, Howard, like, the fact that he came in, did this, shot 70% of the movie, it's coherent, and you don't feel like anybody was tugging behind the scenes, is, like, a credit to him as a director. I know Jay is going to disagree with that.
No,
but
I'm not.
This
just,
is why we love Ron.
He's solid, like.
Yeah,
he's your contractor. He's your office manager.
Yeah.
He's not, like, that's what he does.
Yeah, and the first,
the first
two acts of the movie work reasonably well, like that. They're efficient, they're inoffensive. The third act I actually really liked, when it gets to, like, the bit where suddenly the characters aren't doing pastiches of other movies, but in Star Wars, where they're allowed to, like, bounce off each other a little bit.
Yeah.
And you get this sort of, like, general, like, Western film noir thing happening, and you get a bit more Woody Harrelson, you get a bit more Paul Bettany. That's interesting, but that also comes with god-awful amounts of fan service. And it's like, I'm happy just to watch people who aren't, like, Jedis, who aren't, like, you know, involved in Empire's Rebellions.
Yeah.
I'm here for this. Why are you keeping this on at the end when I'm, like, just getting into this?
Yeah.
And, I mean, I have no problem with fan service. It's Star Wars, you know you're going to get that. There is one moment of fan service in this that is worse than anything that's in the prequels. It is, like, groaned out loud in the cinema when I saw it.
Is it a bad sign that I can't immediately think of what this
It's in the first act, that's all I'll say.
Okay.
Oh, it's different than what I thought it was.
Can I say
the fact that three of us can't
would it be going too far?
If it's in the first act, you can
probably
say it.
Yeah.
The reveal of how Han Solo got the last name Solo.
Oh, yeah.
I admire the cheesiness of that.
It's so empty, though.
It's
like
Godfather. It's Howard homaging the Godfather, which I kind of, like, admire in, like, a brazen Howard likes good movies and has good taste and wants to do a Star Wars movie.
If he has good taste, he shouldn't write
a
bad joke.
I'm sorry, but, like, there's two things, right? Like, my takeaways from this conversation is, like, I know Ron Howard's a solid director in the sense he can. I don't think he's made particularly a bad film. I don't think he's particularly made a good film.
Close.
Really, they're all solid. Forgotten 20 minutes after he came out of cinema. Type films, right? It's probably the best, but it's a relatively low bar, right? So just say that, right? Why, if they're spin-off films and you've got a canon trilogy kind of stuff going on as well? Why the hell are you hiring Ron Howard to make films?
Yeah.
You're not hiring Ron Howard.
Sorry, but why are you hiring Lord Miller to make films
yes.
if you don't want
yeah.
the Lord Miller film?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's my question.
No,
like,
really
why is a Ron Howard film?
It,
why have you seen a Ron Howard film?
Can I offer
it's
a...
It's kind of a shame, because you can see in this where the flair or panache of someone like those two directors would have really elevated this, I think.
Yeah, it's going to make $1 billion no matter what. Why not just make a good film?
I would say, counterpoint to that, the backlash to The Last Jedi and the fact that fandom in
that's
general...
That's my second point coming up. You just brought that
just,
perfectly,
thank
actually.
Thank you. See, I'm, not only was it the Young Chesil Beach segue, the J internal argument segue...
My second
so
point is...
So I know!
I am a big fan of Rick and Morty, right? And I think, Darren, we've discussed this before.
Oh,
with
Rick and Morty.
Dismay, yes. And with dismay at the amount of episodes they've announced that they're going to make.
70, baby!
I was happy, and I mean really happy, to never see another episode because of their fans.
And I think one of the yeah, so right. And one of the reasons I kind of look at Star Wars as this kind of thing where A, their fans don't deserve new films. They really just don't deserve them. Because they're idiots.
A certain cohort.
No, not everyone, obviously. But there's enough fans of Star Wars who are idiot enough to drive down scores on IMDb and do all sorts of stupid things like that.
Launch petitions and get people fired and so on and so forth.
What is wrong with these people? Like, you're getting new films. Like,
I cannot mention Last Jedi on Twitter without it becoming a thing. Like, it's really depressing because nobody follows me. I'm not interesting. Why does my opinion about Last Jedi matter?
But you always catch shit for it, don't you?
I really do. And it's not even like I go out of my way to reference it. It's like, oh, hey, I was...
But what do you do? Do you praise it or do you slag it off?
Because you have a more measured opinion of it, because you're like, some of it's good, some of it's not good.
No, there's no measured opinion on Twitter.
You should have committed to this. And you're like, this is a very reasonable assertion. And yeah, just now.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
It's been 5 months and I still have literally about 90 The Last Jedi related keywords muted forever.
I'd leave them.
It's amazing. It's like Vietnam, except it's a fucking film.
The other thing, though, I'd say is, like, if you have the official trilogy, and then you're making this, why are you making spin-offs of characters that are in the official film?
Brand recognition.
It's Star Wars. You can make literally any. Isn't there like 50,000 tie-in novels?
Solo,
but isn't there like 50,000 tie-in novels?
Yeah,
like,
I know.
Like, surely there's like a billion Star Wars
games. Technically, they
dumped
the tie-in novels,
as they said.
But they're easing into it. Like, the issue with releasing Solo, and sorry, we've gone very deep on Solo, but the issue with releasing Solo in the middle of May, I suspect, is Disney testing the water to see how many Star Wars films they can cram into a year. I guarantee you, Jay, you will get your wish of a Thorn movie. Eventually.
Oh, just the same thing as with Marvel. Marvel took 20 films to get to Black Panther because they needed to be sure that we can release it at all points of the year and we can do it this week.
Yeah,
sure. But all I say is, will there be good Star Wars films in the sense of what I mean is, am I going to see my long cherished dream of a David Lynch Star Wars film?
No.
Or see, that's where I have a problem. Where you're going to get more Ron Howard films.
This is the thing, I suspect.
Well, they're still allowing Ryan Johnson to make his own trilogy, apparently.
You're so happy about that, Grace.
I'm just not gonna see them.
But I would,
it's a very healthy way to do it.
Unless he learns how to write a script.
Boom!
Take that.
The sass is coming from this side of the table.
I would say that, like, regardless of what you think of the quality of Last Jedi, and I am very much on the fence between the extremes of Luke and Grace here, I would say that regardless of what you think of the quality of the film itself is closer to what Jay is suggesting, a director putting a unique stamp.
No, I agree, that's fair.
And I think that, you know, I would like to see more of that, even if it's not necessarily good, because for every bad one, logically, you will occasionally end up with something that is equivalent. Like, this is the issue with what you described as the floor and the ceiling of Howard's quality. And I think you're being a little unfair, but I also think there's some truth in there.
Yeah.
The issue is, if you do that, you end up with a very narrow band of quality. The issue is, you have to be willing to swing for the fences, and you have to be willing to...
Because otherwise you get generic kind of knockoffs.
I don't know, maybe... Regardless, I think the issue with Last Jedi is that it's not extreme enough. I think it doesn't commit to its big ideas, but I like that it mentions them in the context of like a big main Star Wars film. And like, one of the things I actually admire about like Solo is that Solo actually incorporates, like, it basically proves that Rogue One and Last Jedi weren't entirely freak occurrences, because Solo is the safest possible Star Wars movie, but all of a sudden you're including stuff like colonial politics with droids, you're including stuff like colonial politics in terms of indigenous populations, and this isn't a Ron Howard Star Wars film, ladies and gentlemen. And
but that's probably not him.
No, I know.
Do you know what I mean?
I know.
Like, if you give a Ron Howard film from scratch, you're probably going to get
I'm just saying that I think that as a result of movies, if you let the franchise push in the direction of The Last Jedi, you might end up with what Jay wants. You'll end up with a horrible mess of car crash along the way, but those car crashes will be interesting.
The Last Jedi, as interesting as it is, is not a good film, though.
It's a grand film.
It's an hour too long. Because it's a film which had some very interesting ideas that it executes spectacularly badly. And it's not, like, spectacularly badly in terms of... No, like, I mean, it's not that... It's not necessarily that, like, the way they go about it isn't that they make a mess of the issues. It's just told so badly. Structurally, it's a complete mess.
It is.
Like, if you shaved about 40 minutes off of it and just tightened it up, it would have been brilliant. But instead, you had to labor all of your points and then turn back on them at the last minute
I
and just
feel like
actively undo everything you've already done.
We should give Luke a right of reply here, actually. As
sorry,
as
Luke. Sorry, Luke.
As the last Jedi defender.
I don't think The Last Jedi is a perfect film, but I really enjoy it a lot. And I think with the new Star Wars films, if I could put my thinking about Star Wars hat on, too much hat on, or maybe tighten it.
There's no such thing.
One of the things I really like about the new Star Wars films is how much in conversation they are with Star Wars fandom and like are reflective of that in certain ways, and I think the way that The Last Jedi continues to do that, because I think that is in The Force Awakens as well, I think the way it continues to do that and develops that is
Rey is a fan girl. Rey is an ascended fan basically.
Rey is like, but I mean Kylo Ren is
it's also
certain,
a fan
is
a
certain
type
of Star Wars fan, and
the type that Jay was railing against.
And it's interesting to me.
They're bad people.
Kylo Ren represents a certain kind of Star Wars fan, and in The Last Jedi, Kylo Ren gets, in some ways, everything that he wants, and he's still miserably unhappy.
That sounds like the internet.
In The Last Jedi, Kylo Ren is at his most powerful. He is the dominant force in that universe, and it makes him completely miserable. Star Wars fans are the dominant force in American
blockbuster talk. Yeah,
and they've never been less happy. And
that's
what I mean.
That's a real problem. Like.
Yeah, and you know what else is interesting though is that there's a point in The Last Jedi, and it, like to be fair, there's a point where Kylo Ren has the opportunity to make himself happy by making a certain decision.
Yes,
that moves him in a more progressive direction. And he actively chooses not to do that, which again could be taken as a metaphor.
That is
maybe.
True.
I'm not kind of saying this is the final point on it, but they have never, or I repeat, never done better than Return of the Jedi. I never will.
Jay.
Sorry.
We've talked
Return
of
the Jedi is brilliant.
We've talked
these are
about
all great.
Jay.
Yes, it is.
I love Return of the Jedi.
It's the best Star Wars film.
It's the best movie featuring Ewoks.
Doesn't make it brilliant.
Well, it's relative to the rest of the movie.
Watched it on Sunday. It's great.
It is great.
I
was shocked how good it was when I rewatched it.
It's my favorite.
The Ewok stuff is great.
It's my favorite full stuff.
It's got everything that a blockbuster should really have.
Let's try to bring it in a positive.
I don't know that I would call it my favorite, but you know, it's the action in it is really great. It's a funny film. It is tight. It's tighter than you would remember it being. It gets where it needs to go very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And that last act doesn't drag, which for some people might be a problem with Star Wars films. It wasn't a problem for me with The Last Jedi, the way that film is paced. I do see that it does have pacing issues. Return of the Jedi doesn't have that.
Nope.
Oh, it is so much snappier than
yeah.
you would think that it would be.
It's great fun.
With a film that has stuff to wrap up and stuff like that.
I think it benefits as well from having all of its characters so well established that they can just fall into very specific roles in a very endearing way.
Yeah. I think I like what The Last Jedi does with its characters. I like that it challenges them. I like that it sets them up to fail, because I think the characters learn more from that. But I think it does. It knows what to do with certain characters better than it does with others, which is probably a consequence of not having that one narrative voice behind it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, with J.J. Abrams coming back on for the last one,
it'll be interesting.
It's interesting to see what he's going to do with that, because he would have obviously had ideas himself from the beginning about where he's taking those characters. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
But yeah, it was great.
All right. Before this escalates even further, I think we'll sort of wrap up there. We'll be back next week. We'll be covering the Week in Irish Film. But in the meantime, if people are looking to find you guys online, where can they find you?
You can find me on Twitter at Baron Roman.
I'm on Twitter at Mr. Cynical. You can also find me writing on filmindublin.ie.
At JPod on Twitter.
I am on Twitter as at Pixie Grace.
I'm on Twitter at Darren Armistroni. I write for the movie blog, which is with a 0 instead of an O in movie, and I co-host a podcast called The 250, where this weekend we'll be talking about Deadpool 2, in case you haven't had enough of that, Jay. Take it easy, we'll be back. Bye!
Bye.
Bye.